Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Frank, from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
Howdy.
I was thinking about improvising then, nearly tripped myself up.
Oh, yeah, you've stated that's a no. That's not allowed.
Yeah, no. We always screw it up otherwise. What have you been up to this week, mate?
The rest of this whole thing is improvised, kind of.
Yes, that's true.
Well, as you know, it's a short week. Monday was a holiday, which I don't know.
It's Labor Day, right?
Yeah, I don't know. As a business owner, if you, it also drives you crazy that there are these holidays that we have to observe. I resisted for a long time. And like my wife would just be like, she just knew that I would work on holidays. Like, you know, take the big ones off, but Labor Day?
You should be laboring. I actually do try to take them off. It's like in my business goals. Because I don't think the answer should be working more.
Right. No, it's definitely
smarter.
Well, that's true. But if you're not smarter, then you just work more.
Yes. So in your case, you have to work a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, short week. I started a new batch. I'm pumping out bodies on the Haas. While the Haas is running, I'm pumping out fretboards and necks on the Axis machine. We're a little behind on getting our plastics fixtures finished. We had some hiccups in it, some vacuum holding issues.
Because the parts are small.
No, the pick guards, they vacuum down super easily.
Right.
The pickup rings, you know, we're doing some not aggressive machining, but we're doing some, you know, there's quite a bit of machining on the underside that we arched the pickup ring to match the arch of the top. And then we have to hog out that center bit of material. So, you know, we're doing it light, but we just don't have a ton of faith in the amount of vacuum that you have. Because if you think of a pickup ring, not a lot to hold.
Yes, yeah. So did you actually have a mishap, or did you not have a lot of faith?
Well, a little bit of both. There was some slippage of, we were using that vacuum fixture to machine some parts that are a similar size for another fixture, and there was a slippage there.
Right.
But yeah, so it's just we're gonna beef it up with some Mighty Bites.
Which is kind of exciting. Pull clamps or
like those hexagonal ones.
I would definitely go for the Pitbulls over those if you can.
Well, we don't need like 6,000 pounds of force.
I know, but they still work a lot better.
Yeah, our concern is crunching them because they're going to be hollowed out in the center so much. We're really just trying to keep them from shifting.
Yeah, I mean, I would block it in and then put your Pitbulls. So for those that are listening that don't know, the pickup ring is kind of rectangular with another rectangle cut out of the center of it. So in that situation, what I would do is put the pit ball clamps at the very edges where you're going to be pressing against material that's solid all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you never want to clamp on a hollow or an area that's going to become hollow.
Yeah, like, exactly. The thing is now we may have to scrap this fixture, but we're trying to salvage it in the meantime.
Right.
So we haven't left ourselves space to clamp in those areas.
Right.
We tried to pack them in because we were thinking, oh, the vacuum will work great. We've been having a lot of success with vacuum. So this is kind of our first semi-failure, I would say, which is is kind of good. I mean, we've gotten pretty far so far without blowing anything. But
I'm tempted to
scrap it.
Right. Yeah. Don't try to work too hard to save it. And one nice thing that you could do is look at buying bars. So I think you're machining those out of acrylic, right?
We are machining acrylic, ABS, wood, and tortoise shell. That's the other thing. But
if you can get all of those materials in bars that would make, you know, three pickup rings in length or something, then it might be worth fixturing it so that you can. Or, you know, four or two or whatever it is, you can fixture the whole length and then have the hearse like part them, you know, do like a slotting operation to cut them apart from the bar and that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. We were talking about actually just because if we were just doing it out of, I have been buying bars, but I'm still chopping them up to like 4-inch lengths. But we could just machine these out of, you know, a sheet. Like a 20 by 20 sheet or something, 30 by 20. Because we use all these different materials, like the tortoise shell ones, we, you know, there's limitations to that material size and we're laminating it to wood. So the other thing is we kind of want to stay flexible in that we could load this palette with four pieces of black acrylic, four clear acrylic, two tort. I hear what you're saying though, and it's tempting to at least do that for the materials we can, so have maybe a separate palette for doing that. But I was pretty hopeful that this would work.
Well, I mean, it's not really a big deal because you can just run all that stuff through the chop saw. Like it's you know, put a stop on your saw and zip zip zip. Like it's pretty quick to make blocks.
Yeah.
One thing I would maybe think about a little bit is doing a top hat style machining. So you buy stock that's over thickness by, you know, an eighth of an inch. Your first op, you hang onto the bottom edge of it with pit balls.
Right.
Machine all of the stock away. And then one nice thing you can do is actually machine a plug that goes inside the hollowed out section. So you put the plug in and then flip it over into the op 2 station, clamp on it from the side, and then machine the top hat away, and that would let you get pretty darn aggressive.
So that's similar to how we have it set up on the Axis machine, actually.
Right.
We don't do the top hat thing. We fixture it with super glue,
right,
the first op, but then it does have like the part is then put into a plug. We opted to try to change that method because the inside shape, we want to be able to remain flexible with that because certain pickups like humbuckers, some are squarer in the corners, or we could do something like a Filtertron, which is just a bit smaller but in the same pickup ring. So having that constraint inside with, you know, your plug size, it limits
but why wouldn't you just keep a variety of plugs on hand?
Well, so the way we have it set up now, it's not like the plug is built into the fixture. So we would have to have multiple fixtures for different shapes.
And then I was just trying to have a plug that you just put inside to stop it from crushing when you clamp on it.
So
it's just a separate piece, boop, drop it in, flip it over, clamp it down, machine.
Well, it's a different way to think about it. We're trying to just, in the meantime, we need to get these things done. So that's one reason we're trying to just, we think one of these, Mighty Bite clamps will solve the problem in the immediate future. We've been saying this the whole time we're making these, is these are version one. Let's just get them done. you know, make our mistakes. So version two, we've already sort of, I'm going to talk to Mark about those ideas, but we've already, I think, come up with some solutions where we could have been smarter. I think making a vacuum was a mistake though, in the first place.
Making this operation vacuum?
Yeah. It's just so tempting. you know, you don't have a screwdriver to putz with.
Yeah. You really have to think about, so I mean, the maximum clamping pressure you can get from vacuum is 14 pounds per square inch. So you like really have to like, you know, work out the area of your part and work out what the hold down force is. And, you know, if it's anything less than like, you know, 100 pounds or 200 pounds, I would start getting really shy about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we pushed our luck with it.
That's fine. Live and learn.
It's a nice looking fixture, but when you look at it, you're like, yeah, that's not enough. That's not enough vacuum. It looks narrow. Like the gaps between the gaskets are pretty narrow. It's not a lot of space. Yeah. There's some restrictions, some constraints that we're trying to work within that we probably should have just been like, this is not right for vacuum.
Right.
We wouldn't have even needed to do the math. We just went for it.
I did see someone the other day making a fixture where there was a plug that went inside and the plug actually had a gasket slot cut around the outside of it. And then you could use the plug as part of the vacuum area. Right. So rather than having on that second op, rather than having to have those tiny little gaskets around the edges, you know, you could still use vacuum, but the plug helps increase the,
right. Yeah.
Right. But that only works if you have like a shoulder inside that pocket.
Mm-hmm.
That it can go down onto.
Yeah.
So, lots of thoughts for you there. You'll have to post some photos of what you end up coming up with. It's always nice to see fixtures.
Yeah, yeah. I think these fixtures are going to look great. Like this is the op zero. I mean, we call it op one just because op zero. So I don't know. I always find that confusing because it's like it's a two op thing, and to say it's op one, it's like. Was there two ops? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do op one and op two if it's just like two operations. I normally do op zero if it's like
material prep.
I thought op one would be fine, and then it's not enough, and I have to do material prep beforehand. Yeah. Then I get an op zero.
Yeah, because this is like op zero is like the majority of the machining.
that doesn't make much sense unless you're a programmer, in which it makes perfect sense. Zero is right. The start of everything.
Yeah. Op zero is me sawing this material up.
There you go. Exactly.
So that's what we've been working on. So
nice. I actually had a fixture day today too. The fixtures that I use for making the Resolute, I just
threw them in the garbage and started taping them down.
No, not quite. Particularly because I'm machining hardened steel and like the chips are very small and abrasive. I tend to burn through like socket head cap screws and pit bulls and, you know, all sorts of stuff that other people probably wouldn't wear out very much. I go through them.
Oh, really?
I usually burn like most of the pit bull clamps on that fixture don't get replaced. But there's a couple that are like right next to a ton of very fine material removal that tend to get little hard metal chips underneath the heads of the socket head cap screws. And then it grinds out the inside of the pit bull. And it actually gets to the point where the pit bull stops clamping properly.
Really? Because those things are hardened steel, aren't they? Or are you using the machinable ones?
No, they're hardened steel. Yeah.
Okay. Hardened. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of clamp and unclamp cycles with like high torque and yeah, it'll do it. Not too often, but I probably replace one to two a year on that fixture.
Oh, okay.
It's not.
I was gonna say because they're expensive.
Not wildly,
but they're like $15 for each, right?
Are they? I thought they were like seven or eight or something.
I don't know. I should
Do you order yours from McMaster?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've literally ordered one. I've ordered them once.
Right.
But also different ones than what you're using. So.
Right. Yeah. So I went through that fixture, replaced all the socket head cap screws, cleaned everything. I tend to like gently chase the threads in the fixture plate to like get all the crud out of the holes. Cause like the little fine hard chips actually make it into the holes a bit too, like into the threaded holes. Mm-hmm. And then in two cases, I actually had it grind the threads in the holes, like totally away. So I just ended up with a smooth bore instead of a threaded hole. So I had, I had to like just, So I ended up just like, drilling and tapping those holes deeper and then just using longer bolts, you know.
Oh, really?
It's not a pretty solution, but it works. just going through that. And then seeing as I was on the maintenance road, I decided since I've got those new hydraulic tool holders, from Maritool for all of my hard milling, I've noticed that there were some marks appearing on the taper of the tool holders.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
So there were some marks on the tools themselves, which was galling because I was just running the tools too hard. So, yeah, one interesting thing about this, I actually talked to Frank about it at Maritool, and he said that side locks and hydraulic holders, they're not able to clamp the tool at the nose of the tool holder. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, the clamping, like a collet, clamping section. Well, clamps. The clamping...
The length of the contact.
Exactly. So like an ER collet or an SK collet, clamps the whole length of the contact. So with the hydraulic tool holders and side locks, if you start to push them hard and they're like kind of, they'll actually start, like the tool will start deflecting inside the tool holder and kind of rolling around inside the nose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably on a very microscopic level or small, like...
Very
much. You know, when you say rolling around, you picture something exaggerated.
Like a noodle. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't have to be much movement, though. And I was running the hydraulic holders very hard, you know, because I was kind of seeing, okay, what can they take? And I actually managed to weld a tool inside one of the collets.
Wow.
Like it cold welded itself in place, and I had to like take a hammer and punch to like knock it out.
So is that toast?
No, actually, it seems fine.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, basically, I was doing side milling operations in hard steel, and I've decided that that's just like not a great idea, except for finishing. So I went back to high feed, so like using the tip of the end mills.
And just stepping down?
Yeah, and just stepping down instead. And that is a lot quieter, and it seems like the tools wear more predictably. I love the hydraulic holders otherwise.
I've been seeing them around a lot more. Seems like a lot of people are getting them.
Well, I mean, for $200 from Maritool, it makes a lot of sense. Like previously the Shunk Tendo holders that I tried, that was the lower end of hydraulic holders. And those were like $500 each.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I was starting to see some, a couple of little marks on the taper of the tool holder itself, like where it goes into the spindle. And so I just watched a tool change the other day and realized that all of the spring clips that hold my tool holders into the umbrella, like the carousel on the tool changer.
Yeah.
All of those spring clips were kind of loose. So the tool holders were kind of rattling out of position. And then when the spindle was coming down to clamp them, they're kind of like hitting the mouth of the spindle and then shifting as the spindle keeps coming down. So like not catastrophic, but not a good thing. Like I wouldn't want to keep doing that. So I spent a couple of hours this afternoon and replaced every single one of the tool clips in my tool
shop. Oh, so where did you find those?
The tool clips?
Yeah.
They're easy to get for Fidals, thankfully. Great. Yeah, ITS CNC is where I get all my Fidel parts. And I think they're like $12 each or something. They're not expensive.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find an actual price. But yeah, so just went through. It's like two spring pins, like two roll pins, and ATC clip is like $12. Two roll pins and a little socket head cap screw per clip. So just go around and replace them all, and now they're nice and
solid.
How
long did it take you to get those?
Well, me being me, I have them in stock.
Ah, smart. Yes. Had you had to replace them before?
I've had to replace a couple on the other machines, so I just ordered a full set. I actually am going to go through and replace all the ones on the other machine, because I went over to the other machine and started wiggling them, and I was like, oh yeah, these need to be replaced.
So it's not just a matter of tightening them, eh?
No, because it's actually like, it's literally, it looks like a spring clip, like a circlip. Do you know what a circlip is? Like a C shape.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's made out of like heat treated steel, and the two like fingers at the open end actually like spread and then snap back into place around the tool holder. So once they've been holding a tool for, you know, years, they'll very slowly deform and kind of lose their holding power.
Right.
I don't know if any of these were changed since the machine was new. Quite possibly that they weren't. So I'm sure these new ones will be good for another 10 years or so.
Sweet.
Yeah. Oh, I did also notice, every once in a while I'll hear like a bit of a thump when the tool change goes. And I'm like, what was that? And I realized while I was working on it that it has a mechanism called a Geneva wheel, which is very cool, old school mechanical way of
right, kind of indexing. I've heard of that.
Yeah, so it has like a half moon and a pin together on a rotating thing.
Right.
That rotates this weird looking gear. And so for each rotation of the Geneva driver, it rotates the main Geneva wheel, which is the tool carousel, one station.
Right.
And either the Geneva wheel itself or the driver has gotten chowded out, so there's like some slop in there now. And so sometimes when it's changing the like indexing the turret, it doesn't index it far enough, and then the side of the spindle's actually like pushing the turret into place with a bit of a clunk.
Right. As the tool holder's going into the spindle, it's off center, and then
no, it's actually when the umbrella style tool changer kind of moves in from the side toward the spindle, the whole mechanism moves.
Yeah.
And if it's not perfectly lined up, then the drive dogs on the spindle, the drive keys on the spindle face, will hit the aluminum of the carousel.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
And that's what's happening. I had a look in there, and it's made a little dent on one of the pockets. So I was like, okay. So yeah, but again, I can buy the Geneva wheel and the driver. The driver's like $140 and the Geneva wheel is like $180. You know, not a
That's
big
amazing.
Deal.
Amazing. Yeah. So who's making these?
Those are all from ITS again.
They're not new stock or anything like that?
I don't believe so. I think some stuff is, but everything I've ordered from them was new parts.
Crazy. That's awesome.
Yeah. So they used to be one of the electronics testing houses and supply houses for Fidal. Mm-hmm. So they used to supply all of the computer boards and that kind of stuff. So I think they just like when Fidal went out of business, they just expanded into supplying all the spare parts for these machines.
Cool. That's a cool business.
Yeah. So yeah, that was fun. Nice. It's always nice to put a bit of a polish on stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because sometimes you're forced to do these like maintenance things or fix something, and it always kind of sucks. And then at the end, you're like, well, I feel a lot better now about this machine.
Yeah. Yeah, I always kind of, I don't know, I kind of enjoy it. I kind of enjoy being a mechanic, so it's
yeah, not too bad. Yeah, you would. You're sick.
Yeah, right. I did get an exciting package this afternoon.
Oh,
I don't know if I said on the last show that I was going to order some of those Zebek deburring brushes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, these aren't the ones that Maritool is going to bring in for you, are they?
No. So Frank at Maritool was lovely. I said that I was looking at these brushes, and he was like, "Oh, let me talk to my brush supplier." He's a brush supplier that he's like looking at dealing with. So he sent me a whole bunch of samples. He sent me like 8 different brushes. And those are all abrasive impregnated nylon brushes. So okay. The individual bristles in the brush are like nylon plastic with like grains of abrasive in there.
Okay.
And I've tried other brushes like that in the past. And the issue is that because basically I'm trying to brush the little fine tool marks out of hardened tool steel. You know, it's like 63 Rockwell, right? So you have to get quite a lot of cutting action in there. And so these brushes from Zebek are like astronomically expensive. I ordered one that is 16 millimeters in diameter, so like half an inch ish, with the little holder for it, and it was $500
for a brush.
Yeah, just for like one brush and the holder. So like they are not cheap. And I didn't realize why they were different, like why they claimed that they were so much better until I like really went through their website. I think they're a Japanese company, and so they're like their communication isn't necessarily the best in terms of like saying why they're better, if that makes sense.
Right.
So it turns out the bristles on this brush are, so like you think of like glass fiber, right? You have an individual kind of strand of this really strong glass.
Yeah.
Basically, they make ceramic fiber that's like long like that, like glass fiber.
Okay.
And cool. Then they bundle a bunch of them together with a binder, and that is one bristle in the brush.
Right.
And then you have, you know, hundreds of those. So the individual bristles, you can bend them like 180 degrees, like back on themselves, and then let them go, and they like snap back into place. They're like really, really stiff. And
it's crazy like, that they're so flexible. Though.
Yeah, well, I mean, glass fiber is as well. I mean, so I haven't bent one 180 degrees, but you get what I mean. Like the nylon brushes very quickly take a set. The actual bristles like kind of fray outward. These ones, they're supposed to stay straight, basically until they're like little stubs. And it's all because of it's actually like a ceramic fiber. And the other thing is that it's like 80% abrasive. Whereas the nylon brushes are like, you know, maybe 20% abrasive. The way that I've been like initially testing these brushes to see whether they're aggressive enough is I just chuck them in a hand drill and like try it on a piece of hardened steel and see whether it's actually cutting or not. And like a lot of the nylon brushes like barely even touch the steel. And then the ones that were really aggressive, I tried them in the CNC machine and yeah, they didn't really do anything. The Zebek brush, even by hand, was like almost making tool marks disappear. So
oh shit,
yeah, I'm very excited to see
what diameter did you get?
It's a bit over half an inch, like 5/8 or 3/4, something like that.
I'm looking at these online, and I mean, in a way, it's kind of what I expected. It looks like a brush, but it looks pretty serious.
Yeah, and they make ones up to like 20 inches in diameter.
Wow. Yeah. These are the coolest brushes I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I spent more than the cost of one of those brushes trying other less expensive brushes.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, sometimes you end up like pissing money down the drain when you're trying to save money. So we'll see what happens.
I know that those big price tags often are a little scary.
Yes.
When you're like doing something sort of like prototype-y like this.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, if it works, it's going to be pretty revolutionary for my process. Because with the kitchen knife, what I'm going to be doing is machining the bevel of the kitchen knife, but not doing the S grind, like the relieved part of the blade, not doing the holes or anything through it. And then come in with the brush and polish that whole like relatively flat surface. You know, there's no corners or anything to round over, so I can be really aggressive. And then come in afterwards and cut in the extra features. And then I can deburr those or brush those individually as well.
Right.
So it, I don't know if it works. I may end up having like several grades of these brushes because I bought the coarsest one, but then they also make four finer grades.
Cool. So if it does remove the tool marks, then you could step down and, or is it up in grit like sandpaper?
I would be, yeah, I guess I'd be stepping up in grit to a finer brush. And yeah, like doing polishing.
It'd be so cool to see how far you could push that.
Yeah. I'm excited about it. If it works, you know,
yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Kick ass.
Yeah. I've been doing some, so you actually visited my shop last week.
I did. It's the first time I've been to my tools shop. Borrowed.
And then left. And when you were there, I showed you something I was working on, which was, I was actually like manually editing a bunch of G code, to see if I could improve the results that I'm getting from the 3D contouring on the blade bevel.
That looked finicky.
Yes, it super was. But I will say though, so if anyone else has to like, you know, edit a couple of little bits out of a, you know, G-code program to tweak something for production or whatever, there's an amazing website called ncviewer.com. And you just like upload your G-code file. It gives you a three-dimensional like visual image of all the toolpaths, and then you can like click on a part of the toolpath and it'll highlight it in the text, like in the actual G code, and then you can you know, change it or delete it, and then it'll get reflected in the visual side of it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so that's what I used to do all the tweaking. A couple of hours of code editing and it made no difference, unfortunately.
No.
Yeah.
Oh man, it wasn't that little jog up that it was.
No, so I said to Nick that I thought maybe Fusion 360 was adding some little like lead ins and lead outs in the middle of this like 3D contoured surface, which I thought was very strange, and I thought that maybe getting rid of those would make my machine kind of hold better to the surface, like produce a nicer surface, and it does not seem like that was the issue.
Damn, it sounded logical.
Yeah. Oh, well. I did actually work out how to remove those in Fusion after playing around with it. It turned out that... So I'm doing the... Previously, I was doing the passes 3/1000ths of an inch apart. And in some cases, there was... It's kind of like a step in between those two passes in Z. So rather than being, you know, like a 1 micron step, it was like a 3 micron step because it was on a steeper part. And Fusion was basically in that instance doing the lead in and lead out to try and make that step safer, I guess. So what I ended up doing was actually increasing the speed of the passes from 80 inches a minute to 96 inches a minute, and then moving the passes closer together.
Right.
And that eliminated, like, Fusion doesn't want to do those steps anymore. Those lead-ins and lead-outs.
Okay.
And the surface it produces is actually nicer, but it still has that... There's still a couple of little, like... I don't know. Some of the passes are just not in the right place. And I really do think that it's my machine.
Okay. Yeah. So, an Akumo Genus.
Oh, God, dude. I went down the rabbit hole last week and the week before looking at used machines. Yeah.
Yeah.
So... The dream machine we've talked about on the show before,
the F5,
the Makino F5, yeah. So I got some used prices on Makino F5s.
Can we hear them?
Yeah. So a 2006 Makino F5 with, I think it was pretty low hours. It was like 9,000 spindle hours.
All graphite.
Yeah, hopefully not. 160 US.
Okay, steep.
Yeah. There was a...
For 2006. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, how much are they new?
I actually haven't gotten a price, but I imagine they... Like, given all the prices I've been seeing for used stuff, they must be around, like, 250K US.
Right. So, I mean, that holds... That's pretty good value. Like, it holds its value pretty good, rather.
Yeah. I found one that was, like, someone had taken delivery of this machine and then never used it. It was still in its shipping crate.
New old stock.
Yeah.
EMC, that's crazy.
Yeah, I've never seen that before. So that was from 2019, brand new, basically. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was $199,000 US.
Huh. Hell of a deal. Okay, so that's interesting. $160,000 US for a 16-year-old machine.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Maybe it was 130. I remember thinking it was about the price of the Okumo. So I think it was around 130 for 2006. Yeah, I don't know. At that price, it's like, I think I'd be better off. If I was going to spend that kind of money, I think I'd be better off buying the Okumo.
Yeah, I mean, especially because you would then get the whatever warranty it's got and service. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the warranty on those machines is actually pretty serious. I think it's like a 5-year warranty or 10-year.
5-year. Wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah, because, you know, Nick and I are used to kind of thinking about Haas where they only give you like a 1-year warranty, right?
They do. They did when I bought ours. They had a deal going that they threw in the extended warranty package, which is another year.
Right.
But then, yeah, they were like, well, you're cutting wood on it, so I don't know how warrantyable your machine will be. They just threw that in. I was like, great. Yeah. Thanks.
Just say no. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find the warranty information on the Okumo website. I can't find it right now. I remember seeing a 5-year warranty on something, but maybe it wasn't Okumo, maybe it was something else.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty serious, 5-year warranty. I didn't think that they gave warranties that long. I've seen long warranties on like spindles.
Right. I'm sure if you're like, oh, I crashed my machine, they're going to be like, yeah, good luck claiming the warranty on that, buddy.
Yeah. Well, I've been following your pal Bavaria CNC.
Oh yes, the
did you see
Just Machining YouTube channel, right?
Yeah, well, I follow him on Instagram.
Oh no, I didn't. I
think it's the same guy. He's got a Hermley.
Okay. Yep. Same guy.
He crashed it.
Oh no!
He crushed those spindle bearings. Because Hermley has this. I guess it's an option. That they have these crushable spindle bearings. I think they're bearings. Anyways, it makes the repair super easy and simple. So
that's interesting.
It seemed like that saved.
So it's like a mechanical fuse in the spindle.
I guess so. I can't speak to what it, you know, how it's the engineering behind it, but it seems like it saved them. And that's the second time I've heard of that happening to somebody with a Hermley where that saved them.
Right.
So yeah, maybe buy a Hermley.
I think you have to be a lot more serious with like toolpath simulation and stuff on 5-axis, and then I would assume even with that, crashes are probably more likely.
Yeah, it seems scary. Well, I didn't have a crash, but I did have a weird thing happen with the Haas. I had a software error.
Oh.
And it right in the middle of a program, it just stopped. Spindle wound down and it threw an error code at me.
And had it like cut in the wrong place at all?
Nope. It was right in the middle of a cut pretty much. And it wouldn't reset. Like I couldn't get the spindle up. Couldn't jog the spindle up. Well, I
power cycle the machine or?
That was an easy solution to do that. And I Googled it and I read some forum article or, you know, some forum posts of this happening, or at least there's one, and the person just said to do that. But I was like, well, I'm just going to call Haas. It was one of my work late nights. So it was like 8 o'clock maybe, but they're 3 hours back. So they answered and maybe it was 7:30, but, yeah, that's what they said to do.
Just power cycle it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But it kind of sucked.
Well, I mean, so it's interesting. It's not necessarily the fault of Haas. It's not necessarily the, you know, indication of poor build quality or anything. Because basically, like, we are all being bombarded with cosmic rays. Literally, like, rays from space, rays from the sun, right? So it's literally, like, ionizing radiation that, you know, zips through the atmosphere and hits stuff. And, you know, sometimes computers glitch out because literally like a bit of stray radiation hit the processor in just the wrong spot. And
for real?
An issue. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
I hadn't
thought about it on such a deep level. I thought, you know.
I mean, if it keeps happening, it could be a sign of, like, you know, faulty RAM or something.
Right. That's kind of where my head was going. Something on the board or whatever, something in the circuit.
Yeah. So if you see it happen again, then sure. But I mean, so I had one machine that was like a DIY router that was like completely flawless for the entire time that I had it, except for this one time where it just went haywire and diagonally machined through a bunch of stuff.
Oh shit.
And then I like power cycled it and it was totally fine. You know, so like sometimes weird shit will just spontaneously happen.
Man, that would suck and like, super bad though.
Yeah. Well, happened. So part of the reason why computers in space are so like they're normally multiply redundant. So they normally have like two or three computers each doing the same calculations, and then they all check with each other to make sure that they got the same results. And if they didn't, then it's like a voting system. You know, if two of the computers got the same result, then the results from the third one will be ignored. Because computers in space are getting bombarded by radiation like many, many times more often than they are on Earth. And it causes all sorts of problems.
Right.
There was actually a bit of a debacle in the 90s where computer chips were like failing way more often. And it turns out that... because computer chips were like suddenly in much higher demand than they had been previously, they were starting to buy ceramic. The old school computer chips were actually encapsulated in ceramic. And so they were buying ceramic from this new mine that happened to be like just downhill of an old, like downstream of an old school plutonium mine. And so there was like radioactive isotopes mixed in at low concentration with the ceramic and particle radiation from that was actually causing errors.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our technology
so,
is very strange and fragile on that level, you know.
But what you're saying is my Haas is radioactive.
Definitely.
And now I have superpowers.
demonstrably no.
You don't, know that.
Well, this is a good segue into space. We accidentally ended up talking about space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you covered it.
I think we covered space already.
Yeah. You said radiation, satellites. Now, what? Hit me with the news. Where are we at?
Amazon's having a whinge.
A whinge?
They are a whinge. They are suing the FCC and suing, I think, I can't remember whether it's the FCC or SpaceX. I think
are these
the
people that didn't give them the contract?
So it's funny. So, you know, Amazon is owned by Jeff Bezos, or Jeff Bezos founded Amazon, and Jeff Bezos also founded Blue Origin. Mm-hmm. Blue Origin is suing NASA and the US government because of the moon landings programs that were awarded to SpaceX. And Amazon is trying to launch their own satellite, like internet satellite constellation to compete with Starlink.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, I don't think that they've actually launched any of the satellites yet. And apparently they've taken like 14 months to respond to like a request for clarification or correction to in one of their proposals. But they were very, very quick to sue the FCC and try and stop Starlink from getting deployed. So I don't know. I hate that shit, man. Like if you know, if you were worried about a company out competing you with you, you know, like
yeah,
if they're
be
like
whiny
infringing
about it.
On your yeah, if they're infringing on your trademark or if they're like straight up copying your shit, then I get it. But if it's like they're just competing in the same market as you and like kicking your butt, like,
yeah,
just
too bad.
Be better.
But this Bezos you know? Guy's gonna blow through all his money.
Yeah, well, Elon's been like chirping him on Twitter, saying like, "Turns out Jeff's new because he retired as the CEO of Amazon. He's like, turns out Jeff's new full time job is suing SpaceX."
So
yeah, he actually stepped down as the CEO.
Oh, I didn't know that. When?
Like a year ago or something. Oh,
okay.
I don't remember. Not recent. right before all the lawsuits started.
Yeah, interesting. Everyone's got to have their hobbies. You know, you got to keep busy when you're retired.
100%. So yeah, apart from that, there hasn't been like a ton of news. SpaceX are still working on Starship stuff, and it's still like going at a crazy pace, but it's kind of more of the same. They're still waiting. The FAA is doing like an environmental assessment of the launch site at Boca Chica, Texas, which is where the next tests are supposed to launch from, and they can't do those tests until the environmental assessment is done. So I believe that's kind of what's holding things up at the moment. And yeah, we'll have to see whether Elon gets himself in trouble, because he has in the past completely ignored the FAA and done launches, even though they told him not to.
Such a bad boy.
Yeah, seriously. So we'll see. I mean, there is good reasons to do it. So there was an excellent video by a YouTuber named Marcus House the other day. And he was like, okay, what happens if Starship blows up on the pad?
Okay.
You know, something goes wrong. Interesting. What happens? Interesting question, right? So the answer is we're not 100% sure, but it's going to be an extremely large boom, because there's 160 tons of ultra-dense cryogenic methane inside Starship.
What the fuck is cryogenic methane?
It's liquid methane. So you take like methane gas and chill it until it's cryogenically cold and it becomes a liquid.
Sounds evil.
Yeah. Well, by chilling it down as low as you can, it becomes denser and denser and you can pack more of it in. So SpaceX actually does the same thing with their kerosene. So the rockets, the Falcon rockets, are fueled by liquid oxygen and RP-1, which is a really refined kind of jet fuel, basically a kerosene. And most companies, as far as I know, use that at room temperature. You know, the liquid oxygen is really cold, but then the kerosene isn't chilled. They actually chill their kerosene to cryogenic temperatures in order to get to make it denser. They can actually fit like a couple of percent more.
Cool.
Yeah. So basically, if Starship blows up on the pad, it's going to be at least a 1 kiloton explosion. So that is 1,000 tons of TNT equivalent.
Okay, so how big a mushroom cloud is that?
Yeah, it some of the smaller nuclear weapons that have been built are, you know, like a kiloton in yield. So it is going to be, yeah, a mushroom cloud if it actually goes up. That being said, like, rockets tend to kind of burn fast rather than explode.
Right.
If that makes sense. Tends to be like a really big fireball, because like the methane that's in the middle of the fireball doesn't have any oxidizer to react with.
Right.
Like it has to be in contact with the air or something around it in order to be able to burn.
Right. So it's designed to explode. So it might not be good at exploding.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Whereas the solid rockets, the space shuttle, when it was in operation, had two solid rocket boosters, the SRBs, on either side. And solid rockets are actually a mix of fuel and oxidizer in one place. So if a solid rocket explodes, they tend to do so extremely aggressively, like, you know, basically like a big ass stick of dynamite. So yeah, liquid fueled rockets are definitely a bit safer in that regards, but it could definitely still make a big kaboom. So we're hoping that doesn't happen, fingers crossed, because even though there'll be no one on the pad or in the area around it, that explosion could still like break windows, you know, in the towns that are kind of around the launch site. And it would also potentially do a lot of damage to the infrastructure that they've built for launching these things, like right. The launch tower. So yeah, that would be a bad outcome.
It's not the first time he's blown some shit up either, is it?
No. They actually have SpaceX on their YouTube channel has a video called How Not to Land an Orbital Class Rocket. And it's literally like a 10-minute montage of them having shit blow up.
At least they've got a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, seriously. So in that case, it was when they were trying to land the first stage of the Falcon rockets. And so they're doing that propulsive landing where they actually turn the rocket on and balance on it as they're coming down. And yeah, it turns out that that shit's really hard to get it right.
Yeah, that was some crazy shit to see the first time.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, and now it's like almost routine. It's like not that impressive anymore because they do it all the time.
Oh, they didn't even land it like dead center of the target.
Well, they just did... They just launched a commercial resupply mission to the International Space Station, and the first stage that came back from that landed on their new fully autonomous drone ship landing pad. So it's this big ship that can like sail itself out to sea, and then it holds itself, you know, very accurately in position with maneuvering thrusters on all sides underwater. That's and then crazy. The rocket comes and lands on it. Yeah, yeah. And I also love that the names that they give the drone ships. So there's an amazing sci-fi author from the UK named Ian Banks, and he wrote some of the best sci-fi books I've ever read. And there are like spaceships in his books that have names because they're actually like alive. They're like sentient spaceships. No, they have like really esoteric names like, just read the instructions or, one of them quite memorably is named Meatfucker. Yeah, that one was like a derogatory name for a ship that had been caught doing things it wasn't supposed to do. But yeah, so the new drone ship that they have is named after one of the ships in the book, and it's called A Shortfall of Gravitas. And the landing that they did on that most recent mission was like within centimeters of the middle of the logo that they kind of paint as a bullseye on the deck of the ship. It's crazy how accurate they're getting with that.
That's kick ass. What is driving that accuracy? What is are they using, like how do they nail that target? Is it, I can't even speculate on what that is.
That's a really good question, actually. I'm not 100% sure. It must be a mix of like GPS, because I don't know if they have any, I haven't seen any like imaging sensors on the Falcon rockets, and I don't think it would be very useful because they're like landing in clouds and stuff. Like sometimes you can't even see the ship.
Yeah, I guess once it gets close down to it, but then you know the way that you know it's sort of vertical and it's got all this thrusting going on underneath. Like how would it even see?
Yeah, exactly. So it might be a combination of like GPS and radio beacons. I'm not 100% sure on that, so I'd have to look it up. More than likely, they're using GPS in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, if they are using GPS, they would have to be buying very special modules that are authorized by the US government, because if you just buy a GPS module off the shelf, it actually locks itself down at over a certain speed so that it can't be used in making missiles.
Right. I've heard this, like the accuracy is limited in GPS by the government.
Yeah. So like commercial GPS is accuracy limited, but also if you take like a commercial GPS module and then like put it on a hobby rocket and send it into the sky at, you know, 600 kilometers an hour,
it'll shut itself down.
It'll shut itself down. Yeah. It actually detects it. It's like, oh, I'm moving too fast. I shouldn't be reporting a position, you know, while I'm doing this. And that's literally because otherwise people could use those to build like crazy good, like ICBMs, you know, DIY ballistic missile.
Right. You could send a missile straight to my shop.
Sandwich missile.
Oh, lunchtime. That'd be sick.
Lunchtime, motherfucker.
Eat this, bitch.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen that skit by, what was his name? Bill Hicks.
I have not.
He has this segment on smart fruit. He's like, why aren't we using military technology to feed hungry children with laser guided bananas?
It's a good question.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I mean, that's really all there's going on in space at the moment.
Space. Sec. Well, I'm sure these guys will, you know, do some more exciting stuff for you soon.
Dude, they're just like, they're working at a crazy pace. I mean, all of the really exciting stuff has kind of happened, and now they're kind of doing the less exciting stuff. Like, they've been gluing on the remainder, well, not gluing on, attaching the rest of the heat shield tiles on Starship 20, which is cool. Going to be like
the first glue?
Orbital one. They do not. They actually use these like mechanical fasteners that attach from the back of the tile. And then to remove the heat shield tile, if it gets cracked or something, they just use like a diamond drill and drill through the middle to make an access hole. And then they put like a little probe through there and unlock the mechanical fasteners.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So whereas on the space shuttle, they also had these like heat shield tiles, but they were like glued in place and like every tile was a unique snowflake.
Right.
So it was like incredibly expensive to do the heat shield tiles on the space shuttle. And every time they used it, they had to reinspect every single one. And I think they replaced like half of them every time.
Holy shit. What are they made out of?
It's some sort of crazy refractory ceramic. So like a material that really reflects heat. Mm. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I would assume it's like, I don't know, boron nitride or something like that. Some crazy ceramic material. I could look it up, but I'm not going to. You go and Google it. Boron. Everyone that's listening to this, go Google boring. It and tell me about it. There you go. But yeah, it's super cool stuff, and they've designed it so that they only have to make like a dozen or like 20 unique shapes of the tiles.
That's clever.
Yeah. Because, I mean, most of them are just kind of a curved hexagon. That's it. You know,
right.
And then there are some like pieces around the edges and stuff where they need special, unique snowflake tiles. But yeah, you know, it's one of those things. It just makes sense. Like, keep it simple.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we're talking about with the pickup rings, keeping that you know, inside shape flexible.
Yep.
So we're obviously on the same page.
I think there's a lot of ways to do that, though.
Maybe. Anything else new you want to? Oh, did we have any questions or anything? We haven't talked about questions in a while. Do people send us questions?
Honestly, I've been so slammed. So as you know, I was actually away for a memorial for a family member last week. So I've been just like totally out of time. I haven't really had time to even check the Instagram or anything. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Next week we'll check out. Send us some questions, folks. I know all you guys have lots of guitar questions.
Yeah, someone research what the heat shield tiles on the Starship are made out of and let me know.
That'd be awesome to know.
Yeah. I think we're done. Time flies by, man, chatting to you.
I know. How long was I hanging out at your shop for? I probably overstayed my welcome.
I think you were there for like 2 hours.
For real?
Yeah, it was at least an hour and a half.
Oh man, I was like, I told the guys, I was like, I'll be back in like 45 minutes.
20 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a 10-minute, 15-minute walk. 10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you, so Nick came to my shop to steal some glow-in-the-dark materials. Did you do anything with that yet?
Well, I was all anxious to do something with it, as you know. That's why I came up to your shop. And then I didn't. I didn't end up doing anything because I needed to buy the color, the pigment.
Right, the pigment.
And then now they've got lots of options. And as soon as there's options involved, my decision-making is, you know.
Terrible.
Yeah. So I was actually talking with this about my wife. With my wife. Did I say that? Yeah. So I get analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
I need to make the right decision. So I sit with stuff in my cart. Forever. So anyways, I did buy the pigment today. I bought two types.
Oh, nice.
Two different pigments that are nearly identical in color. Shade different. Right. And so we'll just see how that mixes. Because it's like a bluish green color that I'm going for. But it's being mixed with your glow-in-the-dark powder, which is a light green. So that's going to...
like a whitish green.
Yeah, it's going to affect... It's gonna shift the color a little. So we'll just have to see.
Cool. Yeah, well, thank you for that. Post some photos of how it comes out.
I will. Yeah, yeah, and I bought another rod of carbon fiber.
Yes, good idea.
Aaron was mad at me because...
Nick bought one piece and was going to get it right the first time.
Well, in my defense, it was a 12-inch, or no, 6-inch long piece?
12-inch.
12-inch. Yeah, it was a 12-inch long piece, and that's
there's
like
so many jokes I can make about that.
You wish you had a 12-inch long
12
piece.
12 inches.
Yeah. And which means it's actually 6 inches. But so yeah, that would do like four guitars, 12-inch long rod.
Yeah.
But you're right. And it was $2 right, and I was putting an order in with McMaster anyways. So
yes, there you go. Nice.
I'll keep you all posted.
Well, I'm excited to see how it turns out. Yeah, and post some photos. And yeah, everybody please write in with questions and suggestions and yell at us for not checking our Instagram. Sorry about that. And yeah, let us know what the heat shield tiles are made of. I'm going to not research it now. And we will speak to you all again next week.
Have a good week.
Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.